I'm at the point where, like, you know, Excel is the application I work the most in. Right now, I have Excel and my, like, my LLM, like, side by side. They are equal tools in my mind for productivity. I really think that's going to be where the industry also goes.
Welcome to The Institutional Edge, a weekly podcast in partnership with Pensions Investments. I'm your host, Angelo Calvello. In each 30-minute episode, I interview asset owners, the investment professionals deploying capital, who share insights on carefully curated topics. Occasionally, we feature brilliant minds from outside of our industry driving the conversation forward. No fluff, no vendor pitches, no disguised marketing. Our goal is to challenge conventional thinking, elevate the conversation, and help you make smarter investment decisions, but always with a little edginess along the way. I am delighted to have Melissa Lopez as my guest. Based in San Francisco, Melissa brings 15 years of endowment and foundation investment management experience from two multi-billion dollar Bay Area portfolios, and most recently as managing director at the James Irvine Foundation. Melissa is particularly well-suited to offer a firsthand perspective on both the benefits and challenges of integrating AI into an allocator's framework. Melissa, welcome, and thanks for joining us and sharing your perspective.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm very excited to engage in this discussion with you.
Well, let's let it rip. Melissa, you know, we've talked about this long before the podcast was an idea for me, and it was clear we share the assumption that allocators can benefit from AI. And the benefits, you know, at a very high level could be in achieving operational efficiencies, maybe better investment outcomes, and making better investment decisions in general. Can you give us a few examples of these benefits from your perspective?
Yes, definitely. I am very excited about this technology and its use in the endowment and foundation or asset allocation space. I can think of several ways that teams could use this today, certainly from modeling, faster modeling, more complex analysis. Think in terms of like the liquidity schedule of your portfolio. That is always something that's super hard to get your arms around because it's dynamic, literally changing on a daily basis, flexible attribution analysis, scenario analysis. Beyond modeling, presentation, both the thought development of presentations and the production of presentations can be sped up with AI technology. Simple things that are so important to teams, note-taking, getting notes into the shared systems faster, maybe in a uniform, organized format, maybe even starting to pick up sentiment analysis from the notes that have been taken. Diligence efforts can be improved with the use of AI. You could tailor your diligence to each person that you're interviewing to have just a better interaction in the process of, you know, underwriting a manager. I'm also really loving it for research topics. So as we all know, you know, we read a lot in this industry. A lot of it is provided by media sources, and those can be biased. There are so many instances where I want to go to the original research paper that's being referenced in a media article, but like, who has the time to do that? But now with AI, you can go to the original source, throw it into Notebook LM, have it make a podcast about it, and be on your way getting a good perspective. And then market analysis. Obviously, teams are analyzing the markets already, but you can have kind of more comprehensive perspectives, faster speeds that can complement what the team is thinking about.
Just off the top of your head, you've given us a laundry list of possible use cases that lead to benefits.
Those are probably on the productivity side. I do think that is where the low-hanging fruit is. I think a lot of people want to know, what about on the outcome side? What about on the alpha generation potential, you know, this could provide? I think those are there, but I think you have to do the productivity piece to kind of reap some of those benefits. And the outcome side, I think, will develop over time as you have more of these third-party vendors who are developing tools that, you know, can really kind of escalate or accelerate what the team is doing. But I do think I have a high level of confidence that this will lead to better sourcing, better investments, and alpha generation for portfolios.
Given the productivity benefits and the prospective benefits in terms of alpha generation, these seem to be, I'll say, fairly obvious. I mean, if you step back and think about how AI can help And we see it helping in other verticals in this way. So it should apply here. The question is, what's holding allocators back? Why do so many see the potential but fail to act? In other words, what are the major barriers and challenges from your seat?
I think there are a lot. I think, you know, this technology is coming out at a very interesting point in time. If you think about kind of what a lot of CIOs have been talking to their boards about recently or their investment committees, a lot of it has to do with a challenging performance environment for the portfolio. So in the last several years, we've had very challenging markets for public equity portfolios that are actively managed. And then, you know, more recently, we're having a challenging environment for the venture capital portfolios, just given the lack of IPOs and distributions. So you've got investment committees and CIOs engaged in conversations talking about portfolio positioning to enable better performance. You also have conversations going on right now about more than likely the China exposure in the portfolio and then the tariff impact. So you've got a lot of things to talk to your investment committee about, a lot of performance that needs to be generated, you know, in the near term. So, you know, an AI undertaking, you know, could be considered very much a distraction or a risk that you don't want to introduce at this moment in time. I think some teams are, you know, I think they actually have like a misperception of their engagement in AI. I think there are, you know, CIOs out there that would say, I'm heavily exposed to AI. You know, I'm embracing AI because it's represented so much in the venture portfolio. I'm kind of feeling like my proximity to this innovation in my venture portfolio means I'm being innovative myself, when I don't think that's the case. Or they might say, you know, I've got, you know, team members who are embracing AI individually. Like my team is using AI. I think individuals using AI is a completely different ballgame than kind of enabling a scalable solution that the team can use. So I think there's a little bit of a lack of a self-awareness in that regard that may exist. I also think, you know, it's the job of the CIO to, you know, certainly focus on the risks. And there are a lot of risks, you know, cybersecurity risks, data privacy concerns. There's concern about the accuracy of the output of these tools, potentially, you know, regulatory compliance considerations, potentially reputational, you know, risk to consider. So there might be an over-indexing on the risks instead of also thinking simultaneously about some of the potential opportunities that could be had. I also think by virtue of a challenging environment, I think some teams might be thinking, you know, we have constrained budgets right now. We can't add an additional line item if we're going to partner with an outside party, do a subscription basis, you know, model or something. I personally feel like that is, you know, not a complete way to think about it. I feel like the adoption of an AI tool could potentially eliminate the need for other existing tools. So it might not be a net add. It could be, you know, a net like efficiency gain in your spend budget. And I think there are teams that, you know, are probably pursuing like a wait and see mode. Like it's so early, things are so dynamic. We don't know who the winner is going to be. And the, you know, tool development as third parties, you know, it's a very competitive space, obviously, for third party companies right now. So we'll wait and see who ends up winning, and then we'll adopt, you know, quickly thereafter. I feel like that is like something that you're going to miss, you know, the point of understanding how these tools work, what matters. Doing the trial and error along the way, I think it's really important to be experimenting now as well. So I think there are so many reasons to not adopt this, you know, that could keep teams on the sidelines. But, you know, I feel like we also need to think about like the benefits too.
Let's unpack a few of those challenges and barriers. You mentioned first, there could be a cultural barrier, just in terms of mindset, perhaps of the leadership team or the board. Have you seen this, you know, where And I'm not talking necessarily about capacity, that there's a lot going on. There's a lot going on every day, I assume, for an allocator. You rarely have time to just throw playing cards into a fedora. There's always something going on. But this lack of awareness issue, I mean, how can that be overcome?
I feel like small steps can help. As I listen to like a bunch of earnings calls or, you know, people talking about AI in the corporate sphere, it's very important that the CEO is behind the adoption of AI. And I feel like it's really important that the chief investment officers are behind the adoption of AI and not just leaving it to like the associates who might have a little bit more interest in it. It kind of needs to come from the top down. I think one of the things that hinders that though is I feel like the chief investment officers might not actually even know like what to task the team with or how to go about, you know, the development of these skill sets on the team. It is a little bit of a different mindset. It's kind of like looking at everything that you do and trying to figure out how can AI assist me in doing this. So some of the small things that I've thought, you know, that could be helpful would be, you know, start putting it on job descriptions, you know, for the incoming like junior people as, you know, right along with Excel proficiency, PowerPoint proficiency, but like AI proficiency, like, you know, like kind of state it from the start, like this is the expectation, get that mindset like onto the team, like this is something that we expect, you know, and we expect this to be a part of, you know, the way you execute your job. I think right now, I think teams are still leaving that in the we want a curious individual kind of category. And I think that's way too broad for this. I know for myself, I'm at the point where, like, you know, Excel is the application I work the most in. Right now, I have Excel and my, like, my LLM, like, side by side. They are equal tools in my mind for productivity. I really think that's going to be where the industry also goes. I was also thinking it could be nice to have, like, if you don't want to, like, you know, experiment with a full-on hire, you could do, like, a summer intern or something and, like, you know, someone with a kind of machine learning background and, like, their primary purpose on the team in the summer is to evaluate, sit in all the team meetings and evaluate how can we use AI or apply AI to this and just get the rest of the team, like, starting to think about it on a more regular basis. I also like the thought of, because there are individual members that are already experimenting with this, you know, on their own, like, maybe in a team meeting, like, setting, like every week you have like a little 10-minute session dedicated to let's talk about how we creatively, you know, who like used AI this week in a way that, you know, helped them be more productive and share it with the team. Start to like do some of that knowledge sharing. Something like that's particularly important on the just sharing, like, the, you know, so much of what you get out of AI depends on the prompt quality that you put in. And so just sharing like little prompt tips, you know, to get people kind of thinking creatively and like thinking about it more regularly, I think, you know, are small steps of how teams can start to bring this more into their, you know, normal environments.
I like the intern idea, or, you know, having an associate that's dedicated in this space, basically to kind of keep you current on the literature and the developments, because so much is happening so quickly, but then also to cast an eye on the operations, for example, of where existing and maybe future AI could be used to, you know, as we said, improve decision-making and efficiencies. I wanted to, you know, go back to a point you raised about, okay, you've got CIO, CEO, board awareness. They're saying, okay, let's make this move into AI. One example is bottom up. You have an intern. You also put it on the job specs. So you're looking for full-time employees that have this disposition and competency. It takes me back to something I've written about over the years. And that's the, you know, the challenge in our industry where you face, do you build, do you buy, do you lease? You've mentioned a few times third-party software that could be used. To me, that's kind of a leasing approach where, you know, you're basically paying fee for service. The buying approach doesn't seem to be one that fits with allocators where, you know, an endowment would just buy an AI team and bring them in. That seems like a big spend to me. So maybe we hold the buy and look at lease and build, because, you know, building is something from my perspective, and I've built these, as you know, these, you know, the lab and the output, it gives you a certain sense of proprietary control, and you don't have to worry about a third party either perhaps going out of business, because some of these are startups and you never know what happens, or they could be acquired. So your supply chain is disrupted now because they get bought by a big asset manager and you don't have a relationship with that asset manager in the big package that they're offering. So how do you think about this, you know, as an allocator between building and leasing and, you know, kind of the strengths and weaknesses of each?
My natural predisposition would be this is a lease situation, because I'm thinking very much in the conventional terms of, you know, we lease our CRM, we lease our, you know, like so many different things. You know, the Irvine Foundation, you know, that is a team of you know, a chief investment officer, three senior people, two associates. There's one operations person and then an executive admin. That, you know, single operations person is stretched to the max already and is trying to find conventional technology solutions to help her, you know, scale her own time and capacity. So, you know, the thought of like building it, like, you know, that's definitely additional headcount, I think, at least at the start. Maybe it could be, you know, like later you wouldn't need as much from a headcount perspective. And then it might come back to the person who's building it. Do they have enough knowledge of how endowments and foundations or capital allocators, pension funds, how they work to like make tools that will be easily used by the existing investment team? So, you know, you bringing up the concept of like building internally, like, is an exciting, it stretches my own thinking. It's it's something to certainly think about, but I feel like the leasing it is the one that for some reason I think is probably the more palatable one for something that's already going to take a little bit of, you know, cajoling and convincing to get.
Well, let's say, you know, we pursue the leasing option. And I agree. I mean, intuitively, it's probably the path of least resistance. You know, you don't have to hire some qualified machine learning scientists, et cetera. I mean, you need to have some native talent to vet the software, but that's really more on a functional level. You know, how does it work? Does it meet our needs? And then you do your normal diligence like you would on a manager. Will this software company continue to exist? Have you thought at all about, you know, you're in the seat where you have venture capital relationships, and many of these VCs will invest in portfolio companies that are developing some kind of AI. So you have like these additional resources to help you identify prospective apps, software, companies, et cetera. Have you thought about that, or is that like even feasible for an allocator to use those resources?
Yes, absolutely. So the Irvine Foundation, you know, did have some of the hot names in the venture portfolio that are developing tools to service financial services, you know, clients. We did engage with those companies, but I think it was, once again, it was more like there were different levels of enthusiasm around wanting to dig in with those companies to understand like, okay, how would this work? How would it, you know, integrate with our existing systems? Does this mean we're getting rid of our CRM? Like, how are you going to handle, you know, the confidential data that we get from our managers? You know, are you going to train on that? You know, it wasn't necessarily a uniform enthusiasm about it, because I think there, you know, there is a mentality that's already existing, you know, among some team members of like, we'll wait and see. You know, let's see how other allocators adopt this, and then we'll follow quickly thereafter. So, yes, you know, I think, you know, teams that have this in their venture portfolio, I'm sure they're talking to the companies, just trying to learn a little bit more. But, you know, I don't necessarily know if they're really doing it with the intention to explore it for actual, you know, partnership.
Maybe it's not the VCs and their portfolio companies, but you mentioned peers. Do you see much discussion in the allocator community about, let's just call them AI apps, you know, I'm not trivializing, but you know what I mean? It's software, and these are the third-party vendors. Do you see much communication? And how does it, if there is any, how does it occur? Is there a forum for it? Does it just pick up the phone?
My experience so far has been, I certainly have a cohort, you know, several friends and peers in the industry that I talk to regularly. I have a cohort who like are, you know, equally passionate about AI, and, you know, we are excited to exchange, you know, the latest tool that we're using or, you know, something like that. I have not heard of any of my peers where it's kind of like a mandate from the top that they're doing any kind of implementation from, you know, actually selecting a vendor to provide services to the team. So my impression is that it's still individual team members' interest at other institutions as well. You know, I haven't done a formal survey on that. I have not heard of, you know, like AI forums for the capital allocation space yet, but I'm sure people are thinking about that.
Seems like a good idea.
Yeah.
And it, you know, because if you could associate with certain peers that are perhaps, you know, similar in mission, similar in budget and size, I mean, it's one thing to talk to, you know, the large Japanese government pension plan versus the Irvine Foundation, which is a big pool of assets, but it's a different scale. And I've always thought that there was great benefit in peer-to-peer networking, and there's not a lot of that in our industry in a formal sense. I'm sure you've built a great network. I've got a good network, other people, but it's like it's not been kind of institutionalized. And in this case, you're really not competing with your peers. It's one thing if you and I are trying to get into the same VC fund and there's limited capacity and you're not going to tell me about it. But it's another thing to say, I found this really good app, you know, and it's competitively priced. It was easy to integrate. And I think it would help you solve a similar problem. So there should be some like sharing, but, and I think that would expedite adoption and get over some of the barriers because say you adopted it, you could give a testimonial, kind of like an allocator Yelp type of thing to say, this is how we experienced it. And I'm not saying the software is not good or bad, but it's just knowledge sharing. What do you think about that, Melissa?
I would say a couple of things. Like I would say, and by the way, so I have left the Irvine Foundation. I left at the end of March. And so I feel like I can, you know, say something like this. I feel like the foundation peer-to-peer is, you know, pretty friendly and helpful to each other. I feel like the university endowment peer-to-peer, I think, is a little bit more guarded, you know, of everything. That's just my impression. So I don't know if they would be as willing to share kind of, you know, little efficiency gains that they have found. I'm not certain. But yeah, I think it wouldn't preclude you if you were to share this information with your peers. It's not going to preclude you from getting into, you know, the venture fund that you want to get into. Like they're going to be using it differently. I think that's one of the really great things about these tools. It can be so tailored and specified to, you know, the individual like team, you know, and the way they think about the world. So it's not like you're going to, you know, two teams using the same software aren't going to like get the same output necessarily from the tool. So,
you know, I've seen different allocators and even asset managers, they'll subscribe, I don't want to say acquire, but they subscribe to a certain type of AI tool. The challenge they often have is integrating that tool into their legacy systems and into the workflow. People have done things the same way in our industry for years. And you described at the top of the show, these various functions AI can do faster, and I would argue in many cases better than humans in terms of distilling information. And still, we know hallucinations and the problems. But you got to get people to kind of get up off of their chair and say, okay, I really want to use this and see how it goes. There needs to be some kind of, again, getting back, not the top-down shift, but the top says we're going to use this. You go out, you subscribe, and then it sits on somebody's desk because they don't use it. How do you get over that implementation challenge? I mean, other than just outright, you know, kind of a penal colony structure.
I know. I was listening to some podcasts and they were talking about this within the corporate sphere, how, you know, like they're not necessarily these corporations that have like pursued this or not getting the ROI on it because the team members aren't using it. So, I mean, that, I think it's like, I think it does take some actual training. You know, I noticed when I was using this, you know, when I was still at the Irvine Foundation for a manager re-underwriting, I did some pretty incredible things. And that was with just like a co-pilot, like free trial, like not even a paid subscription. And something that I did notice, I was working with an associate on it, that I had her start, you know, with it, the queries to the LLM for this manager re-underwriting. And you could see, she sent me the whole transcript. You could see like her prompts were getting, you know, they're getting better, I don't know, 20 questions or 20 prompts in, and it was generating much better output. And so it was kind of like, you can't let individuals like, you know, wander around these tools on their own because they might not get to that 20 question, like, you know, great prompt. And so they might not get the, you know, worthwhile output out of it, and then they'll stop using it. And so I do think that you have to have like training on like, or at least, you know, sharing experiences of the importance of the quality of the prompt. And this is what creates a good prompt, you know, the little, you know, things that you can say to an AI to generate a better result for, you know, your topic of interest. So I do think it takes training. I do think it takes like sharing experiences of what worked and what didn't work. And I think it does require a bit of a mandate that we are using this. I mean, I'm sure that you've seen the headlines that have come from Duolingo CEO or Fiverr CEO and Shopify CEO saying, you know, you cannot get additional resources until you prove to us that AI isn't able to do what you're asking. And then we'll, you know, if it can't, then we'll give you the additional resources for headcount. Something like that. Like, you have to be using this. And, you know, if you want additional resources, like, tell me why AI, you know, can't meet this.
Two thoughts from your last comments. One is going back to your job description idea, which I think is brilliant, that, you know, if you're an allocator or a manager or a consultant and service providers, traditional service providders, you know, custodians, trustees, et cetera, you should have on your job description, again, depending on the job, something that talks about fluency in AI. In your example, I think it leads me to say you should have a test on prompt engineering. Because that's really what we're talking about. It took 20 prompts to get there. And I appreciate your former colleagues, you know, kind of fortitude to get there. Because most people would say, the hell with it, I can't go any farther than this. But putting prompt engineering as a skill, you know, one of them is kind of remedial. But go ahead, you're nodding your head and you're agreeing. So you must have something better than I have.
Well, no, I was thinking very much along the same lines. I was thinking, so, you know, at the Irvine Foundation, we would issue case studies to the associates. And I'm referencing the associates because that's where the turnover existed. We would have them for 2 to 3 years and bring in new ones. And so we would do a case study for them. And the one that I would give was an Excel and PowerPoint-based case study. And I've been thinking, like, case studies will need to change because I think AI, it can take average people, like an average writer, and make them a good writer. I don't think it can make them an exceptional writer yet, but it can make them a good writer. And it can take an average financial modeler and make them a good modeler. Something I've noticed, though, is that it still makes mistakes. And you still need to be able to identify, to kind of like troubleshoot the mistakes, to understand, you know, what could be going wrong, to revise the prompt that you're giving for the formula that you're seeking. I do think you'll need junior people to still be able to identify mistakes. So they still need to keep learning. They can't only rely on AI for, mm-hmm. you know, formulas. And so I was thinking, like, we need to, like, start changing the way we train junior people, knowing that they're going to be utilizing AI to grab, like, complex formulas that they didn't, like, develop from scratch, but teaching them, like, this is what you look for still and the formula that AI gave you to understand, like, you know, where the mistake might be and how you would change your prompt, you know, in order to get the right formula or something. And so I was, you know, thinking related to the case studies that we give, putting something in like, you know, what are the ways that you would prompt AI, like changing the questions, making them more complex? What are, you know, what are the prompts that you would put into AI to find the answer to, you know, this question? Something like that. But I think there are so many little details that need to kind of be reconsidered. It's interesting.
We've covered a lot. It's been our 30-minute target-ish. I like to keep them short and tight, and you've certainly packed in a lot of information into your comments today. I really appreciate that and the way you've approached it. But I wanted to ask, given that there's still this slow pace of play in terms of adoption, do you think AI will eventually be completely integrated into an allocator's business? Or is there always going to, I don't mean autonomously and we have no humans, but, you know, the kind of things that you've discussed today in terms of the benefits, you think we'll see this? And how long, if so, how long will it take?
I mean, I would love to hear your response to this too, but because you're asking, like, there's a level of uncertainty. And I feel like with certainty, this is going to be integrated into the business. But, you know, I'm not of the camp that it's going to automate the business. I think, you know, this, so much of this world is relationship driven. And I think, you know, that's maybe only becomes more important, as people say, like, lean into your humanness as, you know, AI kind of automates a lot of the production. So I think it will be integrated with certainty. Like, you know, I'm already thinking in my own life, yeah. You know, the prioritization of my monthly expenses, it is like my cell phone bill, my internet service, and my monthly LLM. Like, that's where we are, you know. So I think it will absolutely be integrated, but I think we'll still need people because so much of, you know, this world is relationship oriented.
I agree. It's going to be integrated. It's going to take time. But I also wrote that piece on investment management in a box where you could use multi-agent systems to really perform a lot of the functions. Those functions are probably best suited for an asset manager or a consultant, more so than a single fiduciary. You cannot delegate away that final decision. And you're never going to have a multi-agentic board. I mean, you're going to have trustees.
Yeah.
You know, I'm a trustee on a public plan. I know the people I sit with, and they love them, but I'd like to replace them with an agent sometimes. But I think it's going to happen. It's going to take time because I've been in this industry a long time, and I've seen incremental changes, but very little innovation. But I think AI is kind of the fulcrum that's going to move people much more quickly. And going back to that peer-to-peer conversation and all the benefits that you've laid out, I don't see how allocators cannot embrace this, because it's going to lead to better outcomes for their beneficiaries at the end of the day. So,
yeah.
Well, before I let you go, I've got to ask you the question I ask everybody, and this has nothing to do with AI, and you know it's coming, Melissa. What's the worst pitch you've ever heard? I don't care about what three books you read or what's the best restaurant. What's the worst pitch? And, you know, be gentle to a point, okay?
Okay, sure. I think the one that I will share will be, it was with the manager that is a darling of the endowment and foundation community. And as we were talking to them, they were just very open and excited about the many product extensions that would be available to them over time. We're going to launch this product, and then we're going to launch this product. We could also do this. And they were kind of like bragging about their AUM and its growth, you know, just getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And then at one point, I even remember, you know, talking to them about, like, you know, it was a volatile strategy. So if you fall below your high watermark for an extended period of time, like, you know, how will you think about retention of the team? And they assured me we didn't have to worry about that, because they said, you know, we're making so much money on the management fees that we can like figure something out. So it was just kind of like wide-eyed that, you know, so many things that they said, you know, were not the point of view that, you know, an LP had as being favorable, you know?
Yep.
But I think that was one of them.
We're making so much money on management fees. Who gives a hoot about the performance fee? We'll be great. Thank you for your
it was really
contribution.
Interesting.
I mean, my gosh. Well, that was great. Thank you, Melissa. I have enjoyed our conversations in the past, and this one was no exception. I hope you found it to be worth your time, you know?
Yeah, I loved it. I wish it was an hour.
You and I might, but our listeners won't. You know my approach. Nobody's got time to hear people talk for an hour about this. But maybe we'll have you come back talk about something else. That could be
sounds good.
It could be a repeat, because this has been wonderful.
Yeah, so fun.
Thanks for listening. Be sure to visit PNI's website for outstanding content and to hear previous episodes of the show. You can also find us on PNI's YouTube channel. Links are in the show notes. If you have any questions or comments on the episode, or have suggestions for future topics and guests, we'd love to hear from you. My contact information is also in the show notes. And if you haven't already done so, we'd really appreciate an honest review on iTunes. These reviews help us make sure we're delivering the content you need to be successful. To hear more insightful interviews with allocators, be sure to subscribe to the show on the podcast app of your choice. Finally, a special thanks to the Northrop family for providing us with music from the Super Trio. We'll see you next time. Namaste.
The information presented in this podcast is for educational and informational purposes only. The host, guests, and their affiliated organizations are not providing investment, legal, tax, or financial advice. All opinions expressed by the host and guests are solely their own and should not be construed as investment recommendations or advice. Investment strategies discussed may not be suitable for all investors, as individual circumstances vary.